This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. الحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله وعلى آله وصحبه ومن والاه. أما بعد. It's been a while since we have a library chat, so inshallah I thought I'd do another one. By the way, I don't dress up like this at home. I just came back from an event, so I thought I may just do it while I'm still, before I move into casual clothing. Jayed, so today I wanted to do something very different. I haven't done something about history, and I wanted to begin the topic of history by something that is a well-known incident. Well, after this lecture, I hope it'll be even more well-known, that happened around 100 years ago, and that is the infamous Singapore mutiny of 1915. The backstory for me personally, a number of years ago, I saw a YouTube video of some Muslim soldiers in Singapore that were being court-martialed and then executed by firing squad. And the caption says, and you'll still find it on YouTube, the caption said that, you know, they were refusing to fight the Ottoman Empire in 1915, and so they preferred to die rather than go to the in fight against the Muslim brethren. And I thought to myself, that's a very interesting story, and I filed it somewhere in my brain. I said, one day I want to do research on this story because it was very intriguing for me. And the idea kept on coming to me that I wanted to find out more until, I think, was it 2 months ago or something? I said, you know, I haven't answered, you know, that question. I wanted to know more about that. And so I started reading and researching. And actually, this proved to be far more fascinating, far more convoluted than the simplistic video that was online. And so I ended up reading academic papers, ordering a few books online, going back to original newspapers, because it was very interesting. Intriguing. This is just a brief summary. Unfortunately, I haven't written anything. I don't have time or plan to, but these are my thoughts that inshallah I have. And I apologize if I make some small errors here and there of ascription, but inshallah, the point is to get the conversation going and to have you all start thinking and doing your own research. And perhaps one of you can write a broader book or a piece about this. This story for me was particularly fascinating because it has all of the elements of a drama that we need to understand, a global drama. You know, you have the Ottoman Empire, you have the Indian Muslims still under the yoke of British colonization. You have a very interesting twist here, trouble from America. I did not know this angle at all. We're going to talk a little bit about that. There was trouble from America. There was a direct American line straight to the mutineers. You have a dose of religious fanaticism, and you have a huge amount of chaos and misunderstanding. And the net result of all of this was what? In the early part of 1915, Singapore held its largest mass public execution in its history. And of course, all the people that were executed were Muslims. May Allah Azza wa Jalla have mercy on them. And we're going to discuss their story today. Actually, we have some footage or some pictures of that. So let me see if I can put that picture on right now. So this is one of the pictures, one of the main pictures that we have right before the execution. So how did all of this happen? That's going to be our library chat for today. And again, as usual, it's a summary. To set up the story, we're talking about 1914, 1915, 105 years ago. And of course, the British Empire was pretty much, you know, at its pinnacle, but of course the decline had begun. I shouldn't say at its pinnacle, the pinnacle would have been before this, but the decline had begun. But still, the sun did not set on the British Empire at this point in time. The entire globe, there were protectorates. The Brits controlled like a fourth of the entire globe at this point in time. And most significantly for us, India and Singapore. India and Singapore are both British territories. World War I has just begun. Remember, you should know your basic history, that in World War I, Germany and the Austro-Hungarian Empire were together, and they then coaxed in, one day we will inshallah talk about this because it's a very important part of our history, they coaxed in the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire did not have to join. قَدَّرَ اللَّهُ مَا شَاءَ فَعَلْ. What happened, happened, but the Ottoman Empire did decide to join. And of course, the rest, as they say, is history. I've already spoken about that in the video of 1914 that I did and the making of the modern Muslim world. But the point is, World War I has begun. And remember, Great Britain, with the Allies, are on the other side of Germany, and Germany is pulling in the Ottoman Empire. So you have Great Britain on one side and the Ottoman Empire on the other. Hence, the majority of the Muslim world is going to follow the Ottoman Empire. The bulk of Islamdom, the bulk of the lands of Islam, are looking to the Ottoman Khalifa, the Ottoman Sultan, and by default, they're simply siding with the Ottoman Empire because, of course, the Ottoman Khalifa is the titular head of the Muslim world. But the question arises, how about the British Muslims, right? Then remember now, England had many territories, especially India, where you have hundreds of millions of Muslims. In fact, roughly 270 million Muslims were under nominal British rule. That is around a fourth of the entire Muslims of the globe. So three-fourths were kind of sort of nominally attached to the Ottoman Empire. Remember, nominally, not every single, you know, independent or sultanate or whatnot is strongly attached, but still, roughly, the majority of the Muslim world is with the Ottoman Empire. And then one-fourth of the lands of Islam are basically under nominal British control. So what's going to happen? These are the recipes for a disaster that's going to take place. And this mutiny of Singapore is but one indication of this tension. And of course, one other incident or one other thing to lay the stage, and this is a very important part of our history. I really want to talk about this in another lecture but it's very sensitive, as we will see. The Germans manipulated the Ottoman Empire to issue a fatwa by the Sheikh al-Islam. The Ottomans had a Sheikh al-Islam. The Ottomans had obviously the chief, you know, Sheikh. They called him Sheikh al-Islam, means the Grand Mufti. In our times, we call him the Grand Mufti. And the Germans maneuvered, put pressure, and did various things such that the Sultan gave the command that a fatwa should be given from the Sheikh al-Islam. So the Sheikh al-Islam issued a very famous fatwa. Again, it is translated. You can find it online. It was actually officially, you know, delivered. You actually have video footage. There's also video footage of that somewhere online. Very briefly, a video footage of that. The Sheikh al-Islam gave a fatwa that it is the religious duty of Muslims around the globe to side with Germany. Right? And he called this global conflict a jihad. And again, hindsight's 2020, the Ottoman Empire did not have to join. The Ottoman Empire could have remained neutral. And of course, Qaddar Allah, it happened. Of course, the what if question always comes, even though we shouldn't go down that. The what if question always comes, that what if the Ottoman Empire had not joined? But anyway, لِيَقْضِي اللَّهُ أَمْرًا كَانَ مَفْعُولًا. That was bound to happen because it was Allah's Qadr. Nonetheless, the Shaykh al-Islam then gave a fatwa stating that the Muslims around the globe must side with the German side, and of course because the Ottomans were on their side, and they could not side with the British, okay? And the European authorities were trying their best as well to get fatwas from ulama on the Indian side. And of course, the entire Mirza Ghulam issue and all that also comes into play at this point in time. But they're trying to get not just him. They had plenty of people on their side trying to give fatwas that you should be siding with the British, you know, and against the Ottomans. So there's this game going on. And as usual, many Muslim lands and unfortunately some Muslim scholars are being taken up as pawns in this entire game between the superpowers. Now, all of this is secondary to our actual story. I'm just laying the ground, setting up the stage. Let's begin our actual story. In March 1914, the British issued a command to some of the Indian troops. They were called sepoys. The sepoys are basically Indians that are working for the British. So the British issued a command to take certain troops, certain regiments from India to their other colony of Singapore. So they needed troops in Singapore. And so in March 1914, the command goes out, and one particular regiment called the 5th Regiment of the Light Infantry. Okay, they have their names, they have their groups and whatnot. So the 5th Regiment of the Light Infantry was one of those that was asked to move from India to Singapore. And the 5th Regiment was primarily based in Madras. And for some reason, the bulk of the 5th Regiment were from Muslim backgrounds. Okay, they were Rajputs, they were Pathans, they were all from Muslim backgrounds. And so around 1,000, a little bit less than 1,000 soldiers of the 5th Regiment were transported. They were more than the 5th Regiment, but the mutiny was from the 5th, so remember this point. Of course, multiple regiments and contingents went, but the 5th Regiment was the one that mutinied, and for some reason, this was pretty much almost completely a Muslim regiment. And so many hundreds, less than 1,000 came from the 5th Regiment, were transported from Madras to Singapore. And this took place in the mid to the end of 1914. And of course, World War I has just also begun at the same time. Now, the Indian troops, the sepoys, the Muslims, when they arrived in Singapore, life turned out to be far more difficult for these soldiers. Many of these soldiers had never been away from their families, their parents, or their extended families. Many of them, almost all of them, had never stepped foot outside of India. And so there was a culture shock. And there was also a lot of discontent as well, primarily because the British commanders were extremely incompetent in dealing with the problems. And in fact, the British commander at the time, his name is Colonel Martin. Colonel Martin was actually eventually reprimanded for the entire episode. He was partially blamed for the mutiny because of his incompetence and told to let go. He retired and basically lived a private life after this because of the incident of the mutiny. Colonel Martin was the commanding officer, and he was the quintessential, you know, arrogant, bumbling idiot of the British upper class, completely disconnected from the problems that his own troops were facing, and in fact compounding the problems with his own sheer arrogance. Within a few months, Ramadan occurred. It was in July of that year, and so the hottest month, and the soldiers faced the double issue of fasting away from home on rations that were extremely poor. And in fact, we have recorded documents of them complaining to their superiors that they're not able to even eat the regular food. In fact, there's one complaint that says that, you know, we were accustomed to having, you know, large meals for the suhoor and the iftar at home, but now basically because their salary is the same, their salary is in Indian rupees, right? Their salary is the same, but the price of food is double, triple, quadruple. The price is much higher in Singapore. And so they complained that we're used to eating meat and now we're eating dal, astaghfirullah, yani no gosh, and no salan and no chicken, you know, for food, and they're fasting on top of that. And so there's this whole notion of being away from home, being underfed, and then of course hard work, because they are troops. They're going to have to build the barracks, whatever they had to do. They're in a new land that they have been, you know, this is their job. They were getting paid money. Remember, these are voluntary troops. They've signed up to be sepoys. They've signed up to be with the British Army. And so they have a job to do. And the commanding officers really were not sympathetic to their plight. They requested less work. They requested more food. None of this was given to them. In fact, Colonel Martin and whatnot, he found some Molvi. There's always a few of those. He bought them in, some Molvi by the name of Fazlur Rahman, who, sorry, I don't know the name of the Molvi, the guy who objected to Fazlur. Scrap that, not Fazlur Rahman. They brought in some Molvi who gave the fatwa to the troops that they did not have to fast, that they should basically obey the British and they did not have to fast. Pause here, technical footnote. I can see actually a fiqh argument that if they are travelers, and I don't know what they consider, I don't know their whole paradigm, but I don't know, was that the argument that he used or not? But if they are actual travelers for a legitimate cause, now that's the big issue, would this be a legitimate cause or not? But that's besides the point. Nonetheless, a Molvi was brought in by the colonel to teach or to preach to the troops that they don't have to fast Ramadan, and so don't worry about Ramadan. And a certain private by the name of Fazlur Rahman stood up. We have records of this. And he caused a scene in public. And he said that, you know, you and your Molvis can, you know, go whatever. He was very vulgar and very clear what he thought about this Molvi. And he refused to give up his right to fast and whatnot. And this, you know, he was loudly, you know, clapped and appreciated. The sentiment was appreciated. And of course, in return for that incident, Fazlur Rahman was fired on the spot and sent back to India. And of course, would you can imagine the sentiment, the pain, or the frustration is going to be added. All jokes aside, and I don't mean to diminish the issues. They definitely, you know, it's typical British arrogance. Typical. The British do not learn from 1857. Even the Enfield rifle scandal that took place and the 1857 mutiny. The British are notorious for their complete incompetence when it comes to assessing the tempo of their own peoples, and they just have this superiority attitude about dealing with the locals and whatnot. And this was definitely one of the major factors. Even the internal government trial and the internal government surveys that took place afterwards quite a lot of blame was placed on Colonel Martin and on the internal, superior commanding officers about how they dealt with the precursors to the entire mutiny. Jokes aside, in fact, we do have reports, some of the British doctors themselves expressed their concerns that the troops are malnourished. In fact, a number of them even said that these are walking skeletons. I mean, they're not being fed properly. And in fact, one of them advised that they be given a leave of absence, be taken back to India for a month or two, and then brought back. Nonetheless, as usual, the commanding officers completely ignored this and basically made some sarcastic remarks of Indians being thin anyway and, hard work, etc., etc. And so they dismissed these concerns. We also have, by the way, documented cases of high rates of troops fainting on the job. So the heat of Singapore, the humidity is also obviously very different as well. They're malnourished. They're not getting the typical food. The work is worse for them. They're not taking the concession to not fast. So, it was a very difficult Ramadan, for them. Imagine the sentiment they're going to feel. Imagine how the thing is going to build up. Now, this is the psychological makeup of these sepoys. To make matters worse, two other important factors are being put in, okay? The first of them is that the main mosque of the city, the main mosque of the city of Singapore, had a preacher by the name of Nur Alam Shah. Nur Alam Shah. They had a sheikh or a mufti, Nur Alam Shah. And this Nur Alam Shah was a member of a secret and outlawed party by the name of the Ghadar Party. It was a political party that had branches around the world. And of course, the word Ghadar goes back to the mutiny of 1857. The British called the mutiny of 1857 the Big Ghadar, the mutiny. And this party wanted to resurrect the mutiny. It wanted to bring back the mutiny and genuinely succeed this time around by getting rid of British dominion. So the Ghadar Party was an outlawed party, and it had obviously its branches across the globe. The sheikh or the imam of the masjid there was actually a member of the Ghadar Party. And so he was, and of course he was stationed there before the British, and so he's there on his own. He's the Singapore imam. And he was very anti-British, obviously. He's a very anti-British imam. And he would be preaching to the troops that it was not allowed for them to be with the British, and that he was telling them that they should revolt and they should lead a mutiny, and that the Ottoman Khalifa was secretly going to support them. And so this sheikh or this imam promised them that if they revolted, the Ottoman Khalifa, which he said he was in direct touch with, the Ottoman Khalifa would send troops and help them overcome the British. And he also claimed that he was in direct communication with the Germans, which was a complete lie, or maybe somebody lied to him, we're not exactly sure, but there is no indication that an imam in Singapore would be in communication with the Kaiser, and that the Kaiser had promised him as well that a warship would come and aid the mutineers. And so he's feeding them these, mistruths, right? Whether it was an intentional lie, or whether he's own deluded, or whether he was lied to, but the sheikh of this community, which they're going to for Jumu'ah, and they know him to be the leader, so he's telling them that if they revolt against the British, both the Ottomans and the Germans are going to come to their aid. And he was actually writing letters to the Ottoman Sultan, pledging his allegiance in Singapore, saying that he speaks on behalf of the Muslim community, and saying that, he wants the help of the Sultan. So it is a one way. We do not have any indication that the Sultan actually ever responded as of yet. We don't know. If somebody finds out, then tell me. But the books that I've read, there is no indication that there was any official response. He felt, the self-appointed, he felt that I'm going to bring in, the Ottoman troops, and the Sultan is listening to me. And of course, little did he know that he was being spied on, and every single message that he sent was intercepted and read by the British before whatever they did to him. Maybe didn't even reach the Sultan. I don't know. Nonetheless, so Nur Alam Shah was one of the main religious, preachers who was telling these Muslims, the sepoys, that it was their religious obligation to revolt against the British and to join the German side. It's not as if he was like Muslim versus Kafir. He was Germany versus England. And he said that the German side is basically the side of the Ottoman Empire, so we are obliged to join the German side and to not fight with the British. Now, Nur Alam Shah was not the actual brains behind the mutiny itself, because he did not give a concrete plan. However, he was an instigator, and so he was later on, you know, castigated and charged by the British, but he wasn't a part of the actual plot of the mutiny. Along with the sheikh, along with the cleric, there was also a number of community leaders and activists who were also very active in their anti-British sentiment. And one of the main leaders of the Muslim community in Singapore was a Gujarati by the name of Qasim Ismail Mansur. He was from Surat, from Gujarat, and he was a very rich merchant. He was a social, you know, elite, and he owned coffee shops, and he had plenty of businesses, one of the wealthiest, you know, people on the island. And he was extremely active in spreading negative feelings and sentiments amongst the Muslims against the British presence on the island. And these leaders, especially Qasim Ismail Mansur, he felt that World War I was an ideal circumstance to ally with Germany against England and to achieve independence for Singapore. Again, these are people that are born in India, but they have become, you know, Singaporean. And of course, if you've been to Singapore, of course, it's a very beautiful, very nice, eclectic mix of people all over, the Malay, the Chinese, the Indians. Very, very nice land, by the way, and very expensive, some of the very tall buildings, but very interesting country to go to, no doubt. But the point is that he felt himself to be basically, I don't know how long he was in Singapore before this incident, but he felt himself to be a local now. And he felt that the British should not be there, and he wanted to overthrow the British in the land, in the island of Singapore. Now, this is the locals of Singapore. They had a strong anti-British sentiment. You have the religious, you have the nationalists, you have all of them coming together, and now the troops are listening to them. The troops have direct contacts with these individuals. Okay, the plot thickens, and this is the real plot twist that I had no idea about until I read, you know, just literally, I found this out less than 2 months ago, and I started doing my readings. I read one paragraph somewhere, and then I found that very intriguing, and I looked that up and spent quite a while searching for the details about this particular issue. Very interesting. There's an entire book written about this issue. What is this issue? This is the American connection. This is the connection of American, not American Indians, Indian Americans. Okay, this is a very interesting twist here. Take a step back. Immigration to America, of course, was primarily, you know, not allowed for people of a brown skin and yellow skin, as you're aware, but small batches did come, and there was a small, vibrant community of Indian expatriates in America in the 1900s and 1910s. Not a lot, a few hundred at max, but generally speaking, these few hundred, they did have quite a lot of weight, and they had quite a lot of clout. By the way, one amongst them became the first congressman back in the 40s or 50s. Go look him up. I forgot his name. You can look him up. An actual Indian Punjabi congressman from California back in the 40s and 50s. And he was very highly honored because he was the first, quote-unquote, Asian-American, the first Desi, basically, an Asian-American to be a congressman. Born and raised in Punjab, and then came to America, and then worked his way. A very impressive story from a Sikh background. Most of these were Sikhs. Some Hindus and some Muslims. Nonetheless, back to our story. So there's a vibrant Indian or Desi community in North America, primarily in California, also in Portland, and they are generally farmers. That's where they're given opportunities to own land and to farm the land. And one amongst them, a certain Mr. Nawab Khan, he came to North America around 1906. And he began publishing journals with titles like Free Hindustan and with titles like Ghadar. So he's also joining the Ghadar movement and beginning to foment basically an ideology. And again, I'm not opposed to it. I'm just telling you the truth. Don't read in my own views right now. Towards the end, I'll conclude and I'll give my thoughts, and feel free to disagree with my opinions on all of this. But you have many prominent Desi Americans at the time. And of course, America doesn't mind this per se, because this is anti-British. It's not necessarily, I mean, you know, it's not, they don't view this as being potentially dangerous, because they're talking about just like the Irish in Boston, for example. America turned a blind eye, generally speaking, to what the Irish are doing in the 70s and 80s with regards to supporting of the IRA or whatever. So the Indian Americans, not the American Indians, the Indian Americans banded together, and they began publishing pamphlets and materials that were sent around the globe, especially to expatriate communities, encouraging them to revolt. And in fact, very interestingly, there were explicit commands from Muslims, Sikhs, and Hindus to unite together. There was one pamphlet called Elan-e-Jung, the call to war. And the Elan-e-Jung was literally, it said on it, that all Hindus and Muslims and Sikhs, we are one in contrast to the British. And you should know, by the way, footnote here, there were two primary strands of anti-British sentiment. One of them was like the RSS, which became the BJP, in which it viewed India as being a pure Hindu land. And it was those people, of course, who eventually assassinated Gandhi. Okay, there was the other strand that felt that India was a broad land with multiple, you know, ethnicities and multiple religions, and all of them should come together for a greater India and kick the British out. So generally speaking, obviously the expat community here in North America, generally speaking, they were of the camp that said all of us are one compared to the British. There were a few, by the way, who were part of the RSS type, the precursor to the BJP. These days it's the exact opposite, Allahu musta'an, amongst the Indian community, but that's besides the point. So, generally speaking, the Indians of America and Canada, I forgot to mention there was a group in Canada and Vancouver as well. So Vancouver, the South Coast, basically, right? So, the West Coast of America, that you have the Vancouver, Oregon, California, you have that entire strip. And this is in the 1910s, 1915s. They are publishing materials because America allows them to do so and exporting them around the globe to communities and even smuggling. They're being smuggled into India as well. Now, an incident happened here that caused these groups to issue a particularly harsh a number of pamphlets, including the Elan-e-Jung I talked about. And that incident is, again, separate to our story, but believe it or not, it actually seems to have repercussions all the way in Singapore. And that is that a ship arrived from India to Vancouver. Remember, Canada is under British, you know, it's a British territory right now, and India is British territory. So technically speaking, there was this notion of you're able to go back and forth, and an entire shipload of Indian immigrants arrives in Vancouver with the general expectation of starting a new life. Hundreds, families, children, they're all coming to Vancouver. Under circumstances somewhat obscure, this isn't the time to get into that place, but they were denied entry. They were held outside for a few months or so. Situation on the boat became extremely terrible. They almost, you know, dysentery, malaria, whatever, the outside Canada, literally the docks of Canada, Vancouver. And then the government decides, tough luck, we're not letting you in, go back to India. Now, this caused a huge ripple in the Indian American communities in California, in Portland, in Vancouver. They tried to raise funds, they tried to appeal to the Canadian government, but the Canadian government, whatever at the time, refused. Of course, the Canadian government, meaning here the British Canadian government, they refused, and the ship was in fact sent all the way back to India. Now, you can imagine there must have been families of people, because in those days when one person immigrated, they brought their immediate friends and families. It caused a huge wave of anti-British sentiment, because again, Canada's British territory. And this caused them to release some extremely harsh pamphlets in which they sided once again with Germany against the British. This is now not necessarily linked to Singapore from their mindset, but the pamphlets arrived in Singapore. And that incendiary language, some of those pamphlets and some of those publications were actually found in the belongings of the mutineers. And so clearly that type of thought is also playing a role in Singapore. And in fact, there's even one particular individual who was a part of this movement in California and then came to Singapore, and he was spreading these ideas as well in Singapore. So there is a linkage, believe it or not, from America all the way to Singapore. Now, all of this is the perfect recipe for disaster. The perfect storm is brewing. All of the ingredients, or most of the ingredients that I've mentioned to you, basically, there were more besides this, put them together. Soldiers are tired, they're hungry, they're overworked, they're in a strange land, they're away from their families. On top of that, you have the religious preacher telling them that this is a holy war. If they do this, then Allah is gonna, you know, never forgive them for joining with the British. They have to revolt, and then promising them the Ottoman Empire, the Kaiser's help, okay? On top of this, World War I is at its, you know, is at its very beginning, and their notion of, you know, a new beginning is going to come. On top of this, you have the well-connected, wealthy community leaders. You know, you have the Qasims telling them as well that we're on your side, we're going to help you. And of course, those people are linked to transnational political parties. And of course, you have the American instigators. You always have to have the American instigators. All of this taking place within these few months, you can just imagine what's going on in the minds of these soldiers. All that is required is one spark. And what was that spark? The recipe is all there, right? The firewood is all there. That now months have gone. They've been in Singapore for, was it now, what, 7, 8 months, right? 8, 9 years, not even a year. They have not even been in Singapore a full year, but life is difficult. And you know, those months were very torturous along with all of these ideas that they're being exposed to. Just needs one match. What was that match? In February 1915, the regiment received orders that they would be moving to Hong Kong. Colonel Martin called up the battalion leaders to his office, to his house, and told them that within a week, the entire 5th Regiment is going to move to Hong Kong. And as the news spread amongst the sepoys, again, they're already tired, they're already frustrated, all of these things are there. As the news spreads amongst the 5th Regiment, somebody remarks that this is a plot, this is a ploy, this is a trick, this is a tactic. Rather, they're not sending us to Hong Kong. No, they're sending us to Egypt in order to fight against the Ottoman Empire on behalf of the British against the Germans. And of course, later on, now we now know this was a complete and utter unsubstantiated misinformation. It was a rumor that had zero basis whatsoever. 105 years have gone by. There is no cover-up anymore. Nobody, we know everything now about what is going on. There was never the notion to send these troops to the Ottomans. The British were hesitant what to do with the Muslim soldiers, and especially at this stage, it's just impossible. In early 1915, they would never have sent, you know, Muslim Indian sepoys to fight against the Ottoman Empire at this stage. It's just way too early in the game, even if they wanted to do that later on. And all the documents we have, and they're all public records now, all the documents we have, it's very clear they were going to Hong Kong. Just basically, you know, wrap up here and go to another British outpost and then do whatever needed to be done over there. Nonetheless, the rumor spread like wildfire. And given all that had happened in the last basically 10 months or so, khalas, that's it. Some people basically snapped. And they gathered together and they decided to mutiny. They decided to revolt against their own officers and try to take over the entire island. Now, of course, it took a few days of this talk, and during these few days, you had a few people, you know, the murmurings are going to go back to the elders, they're going to go back to the elite, and so the discontent reaches the ears of the commanders, but with all of the typical arrogance of the British elites, never having learned even one lesson from the mutiny of 1857, which is, by the way, one of my favorite topics, and maybe one day we'll summarize that, because that's a long topic, but again, that's a fascinating episode in Indian history, fascinating episode, and so much to learn from the big mutiny, the First War of Independence of 1857. British did not learn from their mistake at all. They refused to address these rumors. They refused to quell the discontent, and they simply reissued the order, and they said, we are moving to Hong Kong in a week. Okay, that's it. End of story. You know, this is your job. You are sepoys. You're soldiers. You're going to follow orders. All of this proved too much, and the plot was hatched to basically, amongst the 5th Regiment, to basically revolt, mutiny, and kill the British soldiers and take over the island of Singapore. And they firmly believed that as soon as they did that, a German ship would just, you know, waltz in, or the Ottomans would send, not paratroopers, but they would just send there, and they would just basically take over, and, you know, la-di-da, everything would be absolutely fine after they did that. Well, they decided to choose a particular time when ammunitions would be transferred from the storage room onto the ships. They're loading the docks. They're transferring to Hong Kong. And so the large storage room that was full of ammunitions and full of whatever weapons and military equipment, that when that was going to be moved, they decided to enact or to start the mutiny so that they'd have access to the ammunition of that locked chamber. And so on the 15th of February in the year 1915, that's 105 years ago as I speak right now, 15th February 1915, at precisely 3 p.m., an Indian sepoy by the name of Ismail Khan fired the first shot, and that was the signal. Over 400 soldiers, all of them Muslim, maybe one or two Hindus, but pretty much all of them Muslim, over 400 soldiers had already been in on the plot, and they participated in this mutiny. They charged the ammunition room, and then they began marching, you know, to the army barracks and, you know, killing as many British soldiers as they could. And then they began marching outside the barracks into the city, into Singapore proper itself, and marched into the harbor and began shooting any British person that they found, anybody from British background, even civilians, because again, this is military rule. I mean, every Britisher on the island is basically connected to what is going on here. And they went to the German prison, because there were some prisoners of World War One that had been captured, and they're in a Singapore jail, and they released them, swearing their allegiance to the Kaiser. Okay, so they're saying the Kaiser is now our leader and not His Majesty's government. Unfortunately, and this is one of the big negatives, typical reality of our circumstance, they did not have a concrete plan. They did not actually sit through and plan what exactly are they going to do. In fact, to make matters worse, they didn't even have one unified leader. It was just, we're going to revolt and we're going to kill the British and then that's it. They didn't even have an actual one unified leader. They did not even think two steps ahead. So what's going to happen? Complete chaos ensued. And by the way, deja vu, 1857, the exact same thing. I mean, again, I don't want to start there because that's a very interesting story. But subhanAllah, the entire country of India could have easily gotten rid of the British in 1857 if they had unity. The number of soldiers were minimal compared to the people who did not want them there. But again, multiple issues. And one of them was a complete lack of unified leadership. There's nobody there that's going to make a decisive decision that everybody's going to actually follow. And also a lack of a plan. There was not a plan about what is to be done. They didn't think two, three steps ahead. Same thing happened again in 1915. So they go around, you know, the streets of Singapore, literally stopping cars at random, making sure there's no British in there. If there is, they pull them out and they shoot them on the spot. In the next day or two, around 40 British soldiers and military civilians. Again, there's no actual civilians, or maybe one or two were killed as well, holidaying or vacationing. But basically, the default is that everybody on the island that's British is basically working for the government. Soldiers and military civilians, over 40 were killed. In fact, they even went to some houses of prominent people and made sure that there were no British people in there. They did not kill any woman or child intentionally. One lady who was the wife of a colonel was killed unintentionally when they tried to shoot the colonel, and she jumped to try to save her husband, and that ended up killing the both of them. But they did not kill any lady or child intentionally. Interesting story as well, by the one of the books I was reading, is that they stopped a car that had a Caucasian man in it, and they were about to kill him. And he goes in his accent, which I'm not going to even try to imitate. He goes, "What do you think you're doing? I'm Irish, okay? I'm not British." So when they figured out he's Irish, they apologized and they let him go. Even they recognized the plight of the Irish. Our hearts are with you, Irish people. We know what happened, and are definitely you are very. We're on your side. Don't worry. So and Ireland is one of the most beautiful countries I've visited, and the people. Honestly, one of the friendliest countries I've been in my life has been Ireland, and I look forward to, inshallah, going again sometime. Nonetheless, so interesting story. They let the Irishman go when he goes, "Well, I'm on your side. I'm not on their side." Even though technically he's working for them, but his heart was not, you know, with the British. Anyway, so to compound this, the 15th of February 1915 was at the very end of the Chinese New Year celebration. And so the whole island was in a festive spirit. The whole island was really not prepared for having a military, a coup or a mutiny. And so the British were caught, as they say, with their pants down. Completely surprised, complete confusion, complete unexpected. And many of the officers were on leave. There was no, as we already said, there was no strong internal leadership even amongst their ranks. And so in a very, very bizarre twist of affairs, it wasn't the British who began clamping down on the mutineers. Actually, Russian and Japanese troops intervened, and they got involved to arrest some of the mutineers, and they sent in their troops on behalf of the British. Can you believe, right? And what was most insulting to the British Even the French sent in their warships as a sign of support against the mutineers and with the British. And of course, if you know anything about your French and British history, you know how awkward that conversation would have been when the French kept on reminding the British about that. And by the way, all of these groups, right, they're not friends of one another, generally speaking. But when it came to the mutineers, تَحْسَبُهُمْ جَمِيعًا وَقُلُوبُهُمْ شَتَّى, that, yes, that is true. Yet when it comes to us, they are all going to be gathered together, and you know, they did help each other to track down the mutineers. Some mutineers, by the way, they did try their best to flee the island. Some of them, actually, I think one ship, when they took a ship and they ended up in Malaysia, and so they fled after the mutiny. However, the Sultan of Johor, which is a province in Malaysia, the Sultan of Johor was loyal to the British, and so he had his troops round up this contingent and then sent them back to British authorities. Essentially, all of the mutineers, pretty much all of them, they were either killed in battle to get them back in the next 3 days. In 3 days, the island was captured back. So the mutiny did not last more than 75 hours, basically, 76 hours. So in 3 days, all of the mutineers were captured. Some of them died, of course, you know, in the process of getting arrested. More than 200 were court-martialed. Around 100 or so were given life sentences without the possibility of parole with hard labor. By the way, that's, may Allah protect us. What an evil, it's a very evil thing that would happen back then, that they would just send you to a desert island or whatever, and for the rest of your life, without any possibility of leaving, you would just have to do ridiculous things like pick up rocks and go in a circle, or, you know, just, you know, go to the mines or do whatever, just hard labor. So it's like a punishment every single day for the rest of your lives. And, you know, I think over 100 of them were given that sentence. 47 of them were given the death penalty. You already saw the picture, and we'll show it again, inshallah, at the end as well. 47 of them were executed by the firing squad in the largest mass execution in the history of Singapore. And they were executed outside of the prison, the prison wall. So the prison that they were in, the wall that you see, that's the outside of the prison wall. The socialite Qasim Mansur, the Gujarati coffee man, he too was arrested. And of course, he's a civilian. And so he thought he would be able to sue his way out. He hired the best lawyers because he has plenty of wealth. And he thought that at least he'd be let off, or at least not be charged, you know, with the death penalty. Nonetheless, eventually he too was tried after all the troops, because obviously he's a civilian. He lost the case because the letter that he sent to the Sultan, that was used as treason, because treason has the death penalty in England and in British territories, even for civilians. And so that letter was used to indicate that he was conspiring against His Majesty's crown by reaching out to other leaders. And so he was hanged to death as well, Qasim Mansur. Colonel Martin himself, the quintessential, stereotypical, obnoxious British commander, and he even has the mustache. I mean, literally the quintessential, you know, essence of British command. Colonel Martin himself, that arrogant, pompous, let me just stop here. He was found incompetent. He was actually reprimanded by his superiors. He was told that he was severely negligent, and he was forced to retire the army in shame and lived an obscure life to the rest of his days. The British, by the way, tried to downplay the entire mutiny. And in fact, for over a decade or two, the details of the mutiny were classified. Why? Why? Because they did not want to spark these ideas in other British lands. And in fact, they claimed that the entire mutiny was not actually against the British Empire. It was just, excuse me, disgruntled troops. They were angry at the, you know, whatever, food and whatnot. So they tried to downplay the notion of a mutiny, because they did not want this to happen across other territories. Other countries, of course, did not have that lockdown, so we can read about, you know, their interpretations and newspaper articles about what exactly happened. Interestingly enough, a small footnote here, three mutineers, Taj Khan, Ismail Khan, and Feroz Khan, no relation to one another, three of them actually did escape. They made their way to Bangkok, and they are never heard from again. I'm sure to this day there are their great-great-grandchildren of these three living in somewhere in whatever, Thailand or whatever, European country, Far Eastern country, without any clue about their own ancestries and where they came from. As a result of the mutiny, the entire 5th Light Infantry, the entire regiment, was slowly just disbanded, ostentatiously as a restructuring of the army. But of course, it left a bad taste, right? When the entire infantry mutineered. So there is no longer in the British Army, the 5th Light Infantry is no longer there because of this this incident. And of course, as a result of this incident, the Muslims of Singapore also faced a backlash. They had to send a very strongly worded message to the crown, and in fact, a mass ceremony was held, you know, by the British vicegerent of Singapore, that he invited the Muslim leaders of Singapore, and they affirmed their loyalty to the king, and they disavowed any knowledge of the plot, and they said that they would be loyal citizens, and by and large, that was true. The Muslims of the island of Singapore were not really involved in the mutiny, other than these few people. Otherwise, generally speaking, it's true they were not involved in this mutiny. The Western press also had a field trip. The New York Times portrayed this uprising as the greatest threat to British power since 1857. I mean, what an exaggeration. They would not have been able to do anything. But again, this overplaying of what, from their perspective, definitely a big tragedy. I mean, you know, 200 soldiers is not a trivial amount. Sorry, not to 400. 400 soldiers is not a trivial amount to mutiny. And for them to kill, you know, 40 British soldiers and, you know, to take over the island for a day or two, that's definitely, not a trivial matter. At the same time, to claim that, you know, England isn't an existential crisis. No, once again, that fear-mongering that, you know, you cannot trust the Muslims and the Muslims are going to do this and that. The Times of London, the same echoes of the hysteria of 1857. You know, that's another very interesting episode. And the mutiny happened in 1857. The Times of London was worse than Fox News in our times. And the way that they portrayed the Indians who mutineered as if they're all a bunch of savages wanting to rape white women. This is always a motif, right? Brown and black, you know, skin wanting to harm our white women. This is a common motif. And the Times was in charge of that. And so we had a little bit of that. One lady was accidentally killed. It was very clear. Everybody now knows this is when it was an accident. You know, the gun was aimed at the colonel and she jumped in the way to try to protect and to try to stop, but the bullet it was already fired or whatever, so she was an unintentional thing. But again, to exaggerate this, the killing of women and children, there was no killing of women and children and there was no child killed in the entire 3 days nonetheless. So again, all of this demonstrates, we're going to get to our thoughts. I'm going to get my thoughts at the end. But before I get there, let me see if I can play for you a very interesting video I discovered on YouTube. There is actually a video of an eyewitness as an older man. Let me see if I can put this on here. Okay, so I found this video online.
The British Crown Colony of Singapore, 25th of March, 1915. On the slopes of a golf course, a large crowd is gathering. It includes the island's social elite, British expatriates, diplomats, army officers, and civil servants.
This is still a public park right now.
Stand the non-Europeans, Chinese, Malays, and Indians. There is a carnival atmosphere.
Public executions were common throughout history.
Among the crowd is a 6-year-old Chinese boy, Chan Chon Ho.
I heard that Ben Park.
That's the guy. Unbelievable.
If it's true. So I follow the band now, the volunteer band. I have to squeeze around people's legs to find a place in front. So it takes a long time because thousands of people standing opposite the jail, you see.
Chan Chon Ho joined 15,000 spectators to witness the British Army's largest mass execution of the First World
That's
War.
That's the jail they're standing.
22 Indian soldiers of the 5th Light Infantry faced a firing squad of 110.
So 22, this is first batch, there was another batch.
Responsible for defending the island had mutinied. Singapore had been taken by surprise and nearly overwhelmed. Officially, the mutiny was dismissed as a little local difficulty. But as this film will reveal, it was part of a conspiracy by Indian revolutionaries to win their country's freedom by inciting the Indian Army to rise up against the British Raj. A plan backed by Britain's wartime enemy, Germany.
That's a bit of exaggeration. Germany wasn't directly involved.
The conspiracy would force the British government to revise their whole attitude to Indian self-government.
Again, that's a bit of an exaggeration. Okay, so very interesting, right? I mean, I don't know when that was done. And also, by the way, there is a documentary out there somewhere. I tried my best to obtain it. I wasn't able to do that. If one of you is able to do that, please, you know, send me a message about where I can get the documentary done. It'll be very interesting to see that. Okay, thoughts now. This was basically an interesting episode from 105 years ago, from 1915, about the Muslim rebellion of 1915, the Sepoy rebellion. What are some of my thoughts about this? Well, I think one of the main things here is that we really do need to study history. We have this notion. Now, the way that the YouTube video, when I first saw it, was that these are people who loyally, bravely, you know, stood against the commands to fight the Ottoman Empire. They refused to be a part of, anything to do with the Ottomans, and they fought for their lives until they finally died. I mean, it's a romanticization of the entire episode, you know? I mean, there's no question that the British caused some of the worst havoc in the world, you know, pre-modernity or early modernity. There's no question that the damage that the British did to the world and to the Muslim worlds and lands, it's immense. Nobody's justifying any of that. But it's awkward for us to come to terms with the fact that these people who lost their lives, they were not even being sent to fight Ottoman lands. And so we get to this very, very difficult question. I mean, what should they have done? Was it really worth it for them? I mean, remember, they signed up to fight with the British. I mean, in the sense, they are soldiers. They're a voluntary job. They signed up. They went through the training. They're getting a salary. These aren't forced prisoners, right? These are people who have adopted, you know, this lifestyle. They want to be soldiers for the British. And for whatever reason, they had this notion that they're being sent against the Muslim Empire. And I mean, of course, we hope for their, inshallah, shahada, their forgiveness. No doubt there are Muslim brothers. But I mean, are we not going to learn from emotional overreacting? I mean, the sheer chaos, the no idea of what they're planning, just anger and whatnot. And again, this is not to criticize them. They have gone on. Tilka ummatun qad khalat. It's something for us to really think and ponder, is that what was gained by this entire episode? What was the thamara? What exactly happened? And again, now you could argue that this mutiny uplifted the spirits of the Ghadar movement, and that it, you know, caused a spark across the globe that eventually Gandhi and others would write. There's no evidence for this, but still, yeah, if you wanted to, it's a perspective, you know. I mean, you can say this was yet another nail in the coffin of the British Empire, but you know, it's awkward, but let's be honest here. They didn't have an accurate perception of what's going on, and they reacted in a manner that, you know, and again, this is one of our problems here, is that history, that's one of the reasons I wanted to bring up this whole one example, by the way, is that history is one of the least studied sciences amongst our clerical class, right? Amongst the Islamic institutions, hardly any. In fact, let me just say this, I am not aware of any madrasa or jami'ah, or, you know, scholarship-producing institution that actually teaches history in a thorough manner, even in a cursory manner. What we do, even in Medina University, is very literally just the very final class, a little bit of Umayyad, a little bit of, nothing to the Ottomans. We know there's no study. When I was there, and I know it hasn't changed at all as well, there's a complete gap of, you know, 700, 600 years. And even the history that is taught, not just in the institution I came from, but in almost all institutions that I'm aware of, it's a very sanitized, triumphalistic history. Frankly, it is more of a mythological, like hagiography, where you're trying to prove, you know, the gallant nature of every single person you study, and you don't study the other side. A picture is painted that is far rosier than actual reality. Now, if you're giving a children's tale, no problem, go ahead and do that. But if you want to teach serious students of knowledge, you want to teach people who are going to become ulama and community leaders and thinkers, you know, if you teach them a mythology, if you sanitize your own history, you know, what happened in Umayyad time, Abbasid time, what happened across the Muslim Ummah, if you present a picture that's not real, well, then you're going to cause problems down the line. If you have a romanticized version of earlier times, you know, it's easier to fall prey to ideas that are also on the more harsh side or the fanatical side. And again, this needs to be said. It's very awkward. that you will never join these types of radical movements or the jihadist movements. You're never going to join them unless you have a totally skewed understanding of the past. The notion of, you know, a glorious past in which everybody, you know, was living peaceful lives and the Khalifa took charge and wa mu'tasimah becomes like a complete trope of the entire 14 centuries and you don't see the good and the bad, the beautiful and the ugly. Look, no doubt our history is glorious. I say this as somebody who is not a specialist, but I love history. I say this as somebody who studies a little bit of history, dabble. I'm an amateur, not saying I'm an expert, but I have no doubt that our Islamic history is the most interesting and the most glorious history of any civilization, especially early Islam. I have no doubt about that. But that doesn't mean that everything that happened was rosy and beautiful. There are very, very important lessons to learn from history. And if you're not willing to learn them and you have a very skewed vision, well then it's very easy to fall prey to susceptible ideas that are going to then lead you down a road of fanaticism, of romantic idealism, of sloganeering with groups that are just, I mean, that's what I'm saying. If you study history, you really do broaden your horizons and you just flutter down back to earth. You're not going to be easily swayed by visions or versions or movements that are claiming that if you just do this and everything's going to be fine. It doesn't work that way. History, politics, it's just a very different arena, and I strongly encourage any student of knowledge, especially graduates of any madrasa, any institution, that they'll have to study history on the side. And the sad reality is that most of our history, even as it's written, it is triumphalistic, i.e. nitpicking the positives, reading in far more, making these nice, beautiful meta-narratives, and then not really getting to the nitty-gritty of the reality. And slowly but surely, I will plan to do this even in this series that I'm doing here. But again, this is one example here that our brothers, may Allah have mercy on them, who passed away in this difficult manner, who were executed and killed. We hope for their shahada. But they were mistaken in what they did, meaning their perception. I'm not saying whether, and by the way, even whether they should have done what they signed up to the British Army. Again, let's be clear here. If they really felt that the British were that way, I'm not saying they shouldn't have felt. I'm not a supporter of the British at all. But at the same time, then why did you sign up? If that's the way you felt, you should have just stayed in your farms or doing whatever, or even be a part of the resistance movement in a manner that's not going to get you accused of, you know, signing up and being a mutineer that way. I mean, that's like, it's, you don't blame, you know, the other side for executing and for being harsh because you signed up, you claim to be a part of us, you're getting our salary, and then you do what you do. So point being that history is something that broadens your horizon. It makes you understand the good and the bad, the positive, the negative. And also, by the way, one final note before I conclude is that also, one of the ways to study history is that you really cannot just rely on one source or one reference, especially when that source is written from this triumphalistic narrative, okay? It's not going to work. If you want to study history, you really have to firstly study how to study history. I'm just giving you a brief example. For this brief lecture that I gave, and again, I apologize if you find a small mistake here and there. I mean, this is all just from my own readings. I'm not planning to write because I don't have the time or the need to write papers. I am not interested in that. I just want to do this for myself. I didn't even plan to do a library chat on this until I discovered the American connection and the misinformation. Then I thought this is very interesting. Otherwise, I was just doing this for my own interest. But even for this, by the way, I just wanted to give an example, and I'm not trying to brag or boast, but even for this brief foray, I must have read at least a dozen articles. I actually went back to some newspapers, you know, Singapore newspapers and New York Times and others that actually mentioned this, to see 1915, see what they said about this. I read, a number of articles from different sources, article written by a Japanese man in English, I don't read Japanese, to talk about his perspective and what happened. Singapore as well, somebody from Singapore has an article, academic article, that, you know, from their perspective, this is like the first resistance against the British, because again, the British eventually did leave after World War II. So from their perspective, they have a way of looking at this as well. I didn't find anything from the Indian side because I don't read Hindi or Sanskrit. But I mean, if you really wanted to, you would have to find something from that paradigm as well. Also, very important to read multiple sources and books. I mean, I actually ordered a book from England here. I don't know if you can see this or not. There's one of the books I read. Our Name is Mutiny by Umej Bhatia. The Global Revolt Against the Raj and the Hidden History of the Singapore Mutiny. It's a very nice book. It's, again, one book. It's multiple. Each one has bits and pieces. Also, by the way, me personally, the way my mind works is that when I come across something that is really intriguing, I literally just close the article or book and then go down that tangent and then come back. And so in one article I read, this was 2 months ago, there was that brief reference of the American connection. And that, I just found it so fascinating. I literally, you know, shut that article and I spent a few days of my, this is my free time, I'm not, again, full time, just a few days trying to tack whatever I could. There's an entire book written, by the way, about the that notion, that movement. Only a few hundred people, but again, very fascinating. I don't have time to read the entire book. I skim through it, just get bits and pieces, because again, it's not my, I don't have a passion to that level of reading 50 books for this one incident. But again, that's how you study history. Multiple sources, multiple narratives, multiple angles, and then you think about it. You do your independent research. You go back to multiple, again, news articles, whatnot. If it's modern, if it's pre-modern, then still there's more that needs to be done. But there's a method of studying history, of analyzing, of deriving the lessons. And in the end of the day, interpretations are subjective. I mean, I personally, again, I mean, I feel, again, may Allah bless and have mercy on their souls. I am not sympathetic to what they did, and I'm not sympathetic to the conclusions. Now, having said that, or their perception, of course, our initial instinct, and this is our problem here, because it's emotionalism. We want to side with our folks all the time. No matter what happens, we want to be sympathetic, especially when they were executed. You know, that's emotionalism. I mean, should they have done that? And they were misinformed. They allowed their emotions to take over. And the biggest thing is that really, I mean, who you signed up for this? I mean, why did you do that? They should have just, you know, like Mr. Fazlur Rahman, you know, he stood up and he challenged the authority and then he was sent back to India. That actually makes sense to me, right? In any case, all of this leads us to the final conclusion for this. I hope you found a little bit of interest in this. Look, our history is very beautiful, very glorious. There's some really, really amazing lessons to learn, but our history is also very, very human. We have the good, we have the bad, we have the beautiful, we have the ugly, all of it is there. And if you really want to be a thinker, you want to be somebody who benefits, we have, mashallah, 14 centuries of history, and that's just our history. There's world history as well, there's other civilizations as well. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tells us in the Quran to look at the nations before, to look at what happened before us, right? And Allah azza wa jalla asks us to find ibrah from this, and from this Ibn Khaldun and others have derived that we should be studying history, and we should be deriving lessons from the past. And therefore, I encourage everybody who wants to really be a person of knowledge, and even if you're not planning to be an alim or a sheikh, but just to be a well-rounded person, to start taking an interest in human history, and especially in Islamic history, but make sure you study it properly, and you don't study it the way that unfortunately many of our, you know, writers and whatnot do, which is not really, it's not really the type of history that we're interested in, because if you don't learn the lessons from history, you're going to be repeating them over and over again. The wise person learns from the mistakes of others. The wise person learns from what has happened before so that they don't repeat them today. Inshallah, with that, we will conclude. I hope that was of some benefit. Jazakumullah khair. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu.
Ya man ajabta du'a nuhin fantasar wa hamaltahu fi fulkika al-mashhul. Ya man أحال النار حول خليله روحا وريحانا بقولك كون.